Chapter 3 The letter from the Russian banker in Constantinople that Sigismund had translated was the favorable reply Saccard had been waiting for to get things started in Paris. And 2 days later, as soon as he woke up, Saccard had the sudden conviction that he must act that very day, that he must before nightfall have formed the syndicate he wanted to secure in order to pre-place the 50,000 shares at 500 francs in his new company, to be launched with a capital of 25 million. As he leapt out of bed, he had at last found a name for his company, the name for which he had long been searching. The words Universal Bank had suddenly flared up before him, as if in letters of fire, in the darkness of his bedroom. Universal Bank, he said over and over again as he got dressed. Universal Bank. It's simple. It's big. It includes everything. It covers the world. Yes, yes, excellent. The Universal Bank. Until 9:30 he paced through the vast rooms, absorbed in his thoughts, not knowing where in Paris to begin the hunt for the millions he needed. It was still possible to find 25 million without going far afield. Indeed, it was having too much choice that gave him pause, for he wanted to set about things methodically. He drank a cup of milk, and didn't get angry when the coachman came to tell him that the horse was sick, probably a chill, and it would be wiser to call in the vet. Fine, take care of it. I'll get a cab. But out on the pavement, he was surprised at the bitter wind blowing, as if with a sudden return to winter in this month of May, so mild just the day before. Still, it wasn't raining, though large yellow clouds were looming on the horizon. So he didn't take a cab, deciding to walk to keep warm. He thought he'd first go on foot to drop in on Mazaud, the stockbroker in the Rue de la Banque. It had occurred to him to sound out Mazaud about Desgromont, the well-known speculator, the lucky man in every syndicate. However, on the Rue Vivienne, from a sky now laden with livid clouds, such a downpour of rain and hail came bursting down that he took shelter under the carriage entrance of a house. Saccard had been standing there for a minute, watching the rain falling, when over and above the rumble of the water the bright tinkling of gold coins made him prick up his ears. It seemed to be emerging from the very bowels of the earth, continuous, light and musical, like something out of a tale in the Arabian Nights. He turned his head and realized where he was. Saw that he was standing in the doorway of a banker, Kolb, who dealt mostly in gold arbitrage, buying coinage in states where the value of gold was low, then melting it down, and selling the ingots to countries where the price of gold was high. So from morning to night, on smelting days, there rose from the basement the crystalline sound of gold coins being stirred, shoveled out of crates, and flung into the crucible. Passers-by on the pavement could hear it ringing in their ears from one year's end to the other. Saccard smiled with contentment at this music, which seemed like the subterranean voice of the neighborhood of the Bourse. It struck him as a good omen. The rain had stopped now, so he crossed the square and was at once at Mazaud's office. Unusually, the young stockbroker had made his private home on the first floor of the same building as his business offices, which occupied the whole of the second floor. He had simply taken over his uncle's apartment when, after the latter's death, he made an agreement with his co-inheritors to buy out the business. The clock was striking 10, and Saccard went straight up to the offices, encountering Gustave Sédil at the door.
Is Monsieur Mazaud in?
I don't know, monsieur. I've just got here.
The young man was smiling. He was always late, not taking seriously his unpaid, purely amateur post, but resigned to spending a year or two there just to please his father, the silk manufacturer, in the Rue des Jeuneurs. Saccard walked through the payments office, where the cashier and the securities clerk greeted him, then entered the office of the stockbroker's 2 managers. Where he found only Berthier, the manager in charge of client dealings, the one who accompanied his employer to the Bourse.
Is Monsieur Mazaud in?
Well, I think so. I just came from his office. Oh, no, he's not there now. He must be in the cash office.
He pushed open a communicating door and cast his eye around a rather large room where five employees were working under the orders of the head clerk.
No, that's odd. Take a look for yourself in accounts. There, in the next room.
Thakard walked into the accounts office. This was where the head of accounts, the linchpin of the practice, assisted by seven clerks, went through the notebook the stockbroker gave him each day after the close of the markets, then attributed to the clients the various transactions made on orders received, using for this purpose the cards which were kept to provide the names. For the notebook contains no names, just a brief indication of the purchase or sale of which shares, how many, at what price, and from which broker.
"Have you seen Monsieur Mazaud?"
asked Saccard. But no one even bothered to reply. As the head of accounts was out, three of the clerks were reading the newspaper. Two others were gazing into space. But the arrival of Gustave Sédile had been of keen interest to young Flory, who in the morning made entries in the accounts and exchanged deals with other brokers, and in the afternoon went to the Bourse, where he was in charge of telegrams. Born in Saintes, of a registry clerk father, he'd first worked as clerk for a banker in Bordeaux, then, towards the end of the previous autumn, ended up working for Mazaud in Paris, and had no prospects, other than perhaps, in 10 years, doubling his earnings there. Until now his conduct had been good, consistent and conscientious. However, ever since Gustave had joined the office a month ago, he had been veering off course, led on by his new friend, who was very elegant and dashing, had plenty of money, and had introduced him to women. Beneath the beard which hid a good deal of his face, Flory had a nose that suggested passion, a kindly mouth, and tender eyes. And he had now reached the stage of having little private parties, not too expensive, with Mademoiselle Chouchou, a performer at the Théâtre des Variétés, a skinny grasshopper from the Paris streets, the runaway daughter of a Montmartre concierge. She was amusing, with her papier-mâché face and shining, beautiful, big brown eyes. Gustave started telling Flory about his evening, even before he took his coat off.
"Yes, my dear chap, I really thought Germaine would kick me out, because Jacobi turned up. But it was he that she managed to get rid of. Goodness only knows how. So I stayed."
They both spluttered with laughter. They were talking about Germaine Coeur, a superb woman of 25, rather indolent and languid with her ample bosom. She was kept on a monthly basis by the Jew, Jacobi, a colleague of Mazaud's. She had always been with brokers, always on a monthly basis, which was convenient for very busy men with their heads stuffed with figures, who paid for love like everything else, never having time for any real passion. She had just one real worry in her little apartment on the Rue de la Michodière, and that was to avoid meetings between gentlemen who might know each other.
"But I say," said Flory, "I thought you were saving yourself for the pretty stationer."
This allusion to Madame Conin, however, made Gustave grow serious. She was someone to be respected. She was an honest woman, and when she had proved willing, no man had ever been known to chat about it. Such good friends did they remain. So, not wishing to answer, Gustave asked a question of his own.
"And Chouchou, did you take her to Mabille?"
"Goodness, no. Too expensive. We went home and had some tea."
Standing behind the young man, Saccard had overheard these hastily whispered women's names. He smiled and spoke to Flory.
"Have you not seen Monsieur Mazaud?"
"Yes, I have, monsieur. He came to give me an order, then went back down to his apartment. I believe his little boy is unwell. Someone told him the doctor had arrived. You should ring downstairs, because he may well go straight out without coming back up."
Saccard thanked him, and hurried down to the floor below. Mazaud was one of the youngest stockbrokers around, blessed by fate, having had the stroke of luck of his uncle's death, which had made him the holder of one of the biggest businesses in Paris at an age when most men are still learning their trade. Small in stature, he had pleasant features, with a small brown moustache and piercing black eyes. He seemed a very active person, with a very keen intelligence besides. On the trading floor, he was already well known for this mental and physical vigour, so essential in his profession, and which, combined with great flair and remarkable intuition, would carry him to the highest rank. In addition, he had a piercing voice, first-hand information from foreign exchanges, contacts with all the big bankers, and even, so it was said, a distant cousin at the Havas agency. His wife, whom he'd married for love, had bought him a dowry of 1,200,000 francs. She was a charming young woman, who had already borne him 2 children, a little girl of 3 and a boy of 18 months. Mazurde was indeed just showing out the doctor, who was reassuring him and laughing. "Do come in," he said to Saccard. "It's true. When it comes to these little beings, we immediately start worrying. The slightest little thing and we think they're at death's door." And he led him into the sitting room, where his wife was still holding the baby on her lap. And the little girl, pleased to see her mother looking happy, was reaching up to give her a kiss. They were blonde, all 3 of them, fresh as daisies, and the young mother looked as delicate and guileless as the children. Mazurde placed a kiss on the top of her head. "You see, we were being silly."
"Oh, it doesn't matter, dearest. I'm so glad he's been able to reassure us."
Saccard stopped and bowed in the face of all this happiness. The room, luxuriously furnished, smelled sweetly of a joyful family life which nothing had yet come to fracture. In the 4 years since his marriage, Mazurde was hardly suspected of anything more than a passing curiosity in a singer from the Opera Comique. He remained a faithful husband, and similarly, in spite of the ardour of youth, was reputed, so far, not to be speculating over much on his own account. And the sweet smell of good luck and unclouded bliss was really present in the discreet calm of the carpets and hangings, and in the scent with which a large bouquet of roses, spilling out of a Chinese vase, was filling the whole room. Madame Mazurde, who knew Saccard slightly, said to him gaily,
"Isn't it true, monsieur, that to be always happy, one simply has to want to be so?"
"I'm convinced of it, madame," he replied. "And then, some people are so beautiful and so good that misfortune dare not touch them."
She rose to her feet, radiant. She returned her husband's kiss, and off she went, carrying the little boy and followed by the little girl, who had been clinging round her father's neck. The latter, trying to hide his feelings, turned to his visitor with a dash of Parisian humour.
"As you see, there's always something happening here."
Then briskly,
"You have something to say to me. Let's go upstairs, shall we? We'll be more comfortable."
Back upstairs, Saccard recognized Sabatani, standing at the cash desk to collect his profits, and he was surprised at the warmth of the handshake the broker exchanged with his client. Then, as soon as he was sitting in Mazurde's office, he explained the reason for his visit, asking him about the formalities necessary for getting shares officially listed. Casually, he told him about the business he was going to launch, the Universal Bank, with a capital of 25 million francs. Yes, a lending bank, created primarily to sponsor some big enterprises to which he briefly referred. Mazurde listened calmly, and very kindly explained the necessary formalities. He was no fool, however, and did not think Saccard would have come all this way for so little. So when Saccard finally pronounced the name of d'Aigremont, he smiled involuntarily. Of course, d'Aigremont had a colossal fortune behind him. Some said he wasn't entirely trustworthy, but then, who was, in business and in love? Nobody. In any case, Mazurde had scruples about telling him the truth about d'Aigremont after their big quarrel, which had been the talk of the bourse. d'Aigremont now gave most of his orders to Jacobi, a Jew from Bordeaux, a strapping chap of 60, with a broad, cheerful face, and a famous bellowing voice. But he was growing stout and developing a pot belly. A sort of rivalry had grown up between the two brokers, the young man favoured by good luck, and the old man having attained seniority as a former manager, whose sponsors had finally allowed him to buy his employer's business. A man of experience and extraordinary shrewdness, undermined, unfortunately, by his passion for speculation, so that he was always on the brink of disaster, in spite of some considerable gains. Everything disappeared into settlements of debt. Germain Coeur cost him only a few thousand-franc notes, and his wife was never seen.
"Anyway, in that Caracas affair,"
Mazaud went on, giving way to resentment in spite of all his scruples,
"it's certain that Degremont betrayed them and scooped the profits. He's a very dangerous man."
Then, after a pause,
"But why don't you go to Gundermann?"
"Never!"
cried Saccard with real passion. Just then, Berthier, the manager, came in and whispered a few words in the broker's ear. It was Baroness Sandorf, who had come to settle her account, and was raising all sorts of quibbles to try and get her bill reduced. Normally, Mazaud would hurry out in person to greet the Baroness. But when she had lost, he avoided her like the plague, knowing she would make too severe an assault on his gallantry. There are no worse clients than women, nor any more absolutely untrustworthy when it comes to paying.
"No, no, say I'm not in," he replied with annoyance. "And don't let her off a single centime, do you hear?"
And when Berthier had left, seeing from Saccard's smile that he had overheard,
"It's true, my dear chap, she's very nice, of course, but you've no idea how rapacious she can be. Ah, these clients! How they would love us, if only they always won. And the richer they are, the higher on the social scale, God forgive me, the less I trust them, the more I fear I won't be paid. Yes, there are days when, apart from the big companies, I'd rather do business only with provincials."
The door had opened again, and a clerk handed him a file he had asked for that morning, then went away.
"Well, well, that's good timing. Here we have a collector of revenues based in Vendôme, a certain Monsieur Fayot. I tell you, you wouldn't believe the number of orders I receive from this correspondent. Admittedly, the orders are fairly insignificant coming from the lower middle classes, small tradesmen and farmers. But there are so many of them. In fact, the best part, the very foundation of our companies, is made up of the modest speculators, the great anonymous crowd that plays the market."
By an association of ideas, Saccard remembered Sabatani at the cash office.
"So, Sabatani is with you now?" he asked.
"Yes, for a year now, I think,"
replied the broker with an air of amiable indifference.
"He's a nice lad, isn't he? He's made a modest start, he's very sensible, and he'll get on."
What he didn't say, what he no longer even remembered, was that Sabatani had made an original covering deposit of only 2,000 francs, hence his starting with only very moderate speculation. The Levantine was no doubt waiting, like so many others, for the paucity of his guarantee to be forgotten, and he was demonstrating prudence, raising the level of his orders only gradually, until the day when, toppling into a big settlement order, he would just disappear. How could one show any distrust towards a charming young man who has become a friend? How could one doubt his solvency when one saw him looking happy, and apparently rich, with that elegance of dress that is indispensable to, indeed, almost the uniform of larceny on the stock exchange?
"Very nice, very intelligent,"
Saccard repeated, making a mental note to think of Sabatani when he needed to find a chap both discreet and unscrupulous. Then, getting to his feet and taking his leave,
"Well, goodbye now. When our shares are ready, I'll come and see you again before I try to get them listed."
And Mazaud, shaking his hand at the door of his office, said,
"You're wrong. You really should see Gundermann about your syndicate."
"Never!"
Saccard shouted once more, looking furious. He was at last leaving, when he recognized Moser and Pilureau at the cash desk, the former looking very sad, was pocketing his fortnight's gains, 7,000 or 8,000 franc notes, while the latter, who had lost, was paying out 10,000 or so francs, shouting loudly and looking very aggressive and arrogant, as if after a victory. It was nearly time for lunch and the opening of the bourse, so the office was soon going to be almost empty. And as the door of the accounts room was half open, laughter could be heard from within, as Gustave told Flory about a boating expedition in which the helmswoman had fallen into the Seine and lost everything, down to her stockings. Out in the street, Saccard glanced at his watch. 11 o'clock. What a lot of time wasted. No, he would not go and see d'Aigremont. And although he had been enraged by the very mention of Gundermann's name, he suddenly decided to call on him. Besides, hadn't he said he would be paying him a visit when he announced his grand project at Champeau's, just to put a stop to that mocking laugh of his? He even gave himself the excuse that he didn't want to get anything out of it, merely wanted to face up to him and triumph over him, this man who affected to treat him like a little boy. And as a fresh downpour sent torrents of water beating down on the pavement, he jumped into a cab and called out the address, Rue de Provence, to the driver. This was where Gundermann occupied a huge mansion, which was only just big enough for his very numerous family. He had 5 daughters and 4 sons. 3 of the daughters and 3 of the sons were married, and had already given him 14 grandchildren. When they were all gathered together for the evening meal, they were 31 at table, including his wife and himself. And apart from 2 of his sons-in-law, who didn't live in the mansion, they all had their own apartments there, in the east and west wings, which opened onto the gardens, while the central block was entirely taken up by the vast offices of the bank. In less than a century, a monstrous fortune of 1 billion francs had been born, had grown, and had overflowed into this family, through thrift and with the help of favorable events. It seemed like predestination, aided by keen intelligence, relentless work, and prudent, invincible effort, continually striving towards the same goal. All the rivers of gold now flowed into this sea. More and more millions disappeared into these millions, in a swallowing up of public wealth into the depths of the ever-increasing wealth of one individual. And Gundermann was the real master, the all-powerful king, feared and obeyed by Paris and the world. As Saccard climbed the wide stone staircase, its steps worn by the continual coming and going of crowds of people, more deeply worn already than the thresholds of ancient churches, he felt the surge of an inextinguishable hatred for this man. Ah, the Jews! Saccard had that ancient racial resentment of the Jews that is found especially in the south of France. It was a sort of revolt of his very flesh, a revulsion of his skin, which, at the idea of the slightest contact, filled him with uncontrollable disgust and violence beyond all reason. But the curious thing was that Saccard, this tremendous business tycoon, this financial thug, with his far from clean hands, lost all self-awareness as soon as a Jew was involved, and he spoke of Jews with harshness and vengeful indignation, as if he were a respectable man who lived by the sweat of his brow, innocent of any dealings in usury. He had a list of grievances against this race, this accursed race which has no homeland or prince of its own, but lives like a parasite on other nations, pretending to recognize their laws, but in reality obeying only its own god of theft, blood, and wrath. And he would describe it as everywhere fulfilling the mission of ferocious conquest entrusted to it by this same god, establishing itself in every nation like a spider at the center of its web, awaiting its prey, sucking everyone's blood, and growing fat on the life of others. Had anyone ever seen a Jew using his own 2 hands to earn a living? Are there any Jewish peasants, Jewish workers? No, work is dishonorable for them. Their religion practically forbids it. It exalts only the exploitation of the labor of others, the scoundrels. Thackard's rage seemed all the greater for the fact that he admired them, envied their prodigious financial abilities, their innate understanding of numbers, their natural ease in the most complicated of calculations, that flair and that luck which mean success in everything they undertake. In this game of thieves, he would say, Christians are not up to it. They always go under in the end. But take a Jew who doesn't even know how to keep books, throw him into the troubled waters of some murky business, and he'll get out safely, carrying all the profits with him. It's a gift of the race. It's reason for existing amid all the nationalities that come and go. And he would angrily prophesy the final conquest of every nation by the Jews, once they got their hands on the entire wealth of the globe. And that time was not far off, for they were every day allowed to extend their kingdom without any restraint. And already, in Paris, you could see a Gundamann reigning on a throne more solid and respected than that of the Emperor. Upstairs, just as he was about to enter the vast antechamber, Saccard paused, seeing it full of jobbers and all sorts of petitioners, men and women, a whole tumultuous, seething crowd. The jobbers especially were fighting over who would get there first, with the unlikely hope of leaving with an order. For the great banker had his own brokers. But it was an honor and a recommendation just to be received, and each of them wanted to be able to boast of it. So the wait was never a long one. The two office boys served only to organize the procession, the never-ending procession, a veritable gallop through the swinging doors. And in spite of the crowd, Thackard almost immediately went in, joining the flow. Gundamann's office was an immense room, in which he occupied only a small corner at the far end near the most distant window. Sitting at a simple mahogany desk, he had his back to the light, so his face was completely in shadow. Up at 5 o'clock, he was already at work while Paris still slept, and when towards 9 o'clock the crush of greedy appetites began to rush past him at the gallop, his day was already done. In the middle of the office, at larger desks, two of his sons and one of his sons-in-law were helping him, rarely sitting down, moving about amid the comings and goings of a multitude of clerks. But this was the inner mechanism of the bank. The streets outside seemed to come in across the room, going only to him, the master, in his modest corner. And for hours on end until lunchtime, with an impassive and gloomy air, he would receive people, often with a gesture, sometimes with a word if he wished to be particularly agreeable. As soon as Gundamann caught sight of Saccard, his face lit up with a faintly mocking smile.
"Ah, it's you, my good friend. Sit down for a moment if you have something to say to me. I'll be with you shortly."
He then affected to forget him. Saccard, however, was not impatient, fascinated by the procession of jobbers coming in hot on each other's heels, all entering with the same deep bow and drawing from their irreproachable frock coats the same little card, their quotes, with the prices on the bourse, which they presented to the banker with the same gesture of entreaty and respect. 10 went past, then 20. Each time, the banker would take the card, glance at it, and hand it back. And the only thing to equal his patience was his utter indifference beneath this hail of offers. But Massyas appeared, with his cheerful, anxious air, like a deserving dog's body. Sometimes he was received so poorly he could have wept. That day, no doubt, he had run short of humility, for he allowed himself to be unexpectedly insistent.
"Look, monsieur, mobilier are very low. How many should I buy for you?"
Gundamann, not taking his quote, raised his glaucous eyes upon this young man who was being so familiar. Then, brusquely, he said,
"Tell me, my friend, do you think I enjoy receiving you?"
"My word, monsieur," Massyas began, now quite pale, "I enjoy even less coming here every morning for nothing for the past 3 months."
"Well then, don't come back."
The jobber bowed and withdrew, after exchanging with Saccard the furious and desolate glance of a young man who had just realized that he would never make his fortune. Saccard was indeed beginning to ask himself what interest Gundermann could possibly have in receiving all these people. He obviously had a special ability to cut himself off. He retreated into himself and went on thinking. Besides, this must also be a discipline, his way of undertaking every morning a review of the market, in the course of which he could always find some profit to be made, however minimal. He very brutally deducted 80 francs from a dealer to whom he had given an order the previous day, and who was anyway robbing him. Then a dealer in curios arrived, with an enameled gold box from the last century, an object that had been partially restored, and the banker immediately detected the fraud. Next were two ladies, one old, with a nose like the beak of a predatory bird, and one young, dark-haired and very beautiful, who wanted to show him a Louis XV chest of drawers they had at home, and which he refused outright to go and see. Then came a jeweler with some rubies, two inventors, a few Englishmen, some Germans and Italians, every language and every sex. And the procession of jobbers still continued in between the other visits, endlessly repeating the same gesture, the mechanical presentation of the quote. And as the opening hour of the bourse drew near, the stream of clerks coming through grew ever larger, bringing dispatches and coming for signatures. But the commotion reached new heights when a little boy of 5 or 6 burst into the office, riding on a stick and blowing a trumpet, and following him came 2 more children, 2 little girls, one aged 3 and the other 8. They besieged their grandfather's chair, tugged on his arms and hung around his neck, all of which he placidly allowed, kissing them back with that Jewish passion for the family, the long line of descendants which gives strength and must be defended. All at once he seemed to remember Saccard.
"Ah, my good friend, please excuse me, as you see I don't have a minute to myself. You're going to tell me about your business."
And he was just beginning to listen, when a clerk who had shown in a tall, blonde gentleman came and whispered a name in his ear, and he stood up at once, though quite unhurriedly, and went to confer with the gentleman in front of another window, while one of his sons carried on receiving the jobbers and dealers in his stead. In spite of his suppressed irritation, Saccard was beginning to feel a certain respect. He had recognized the blonde gentleman, a representative of one of the great powers,
full of arrogance at the Tuileries, but here with head slightly bowed, smiling and seeking a favor.
Top public service officials, even ministers of the emperor, would quite frequently be received like that, standing up, in this room which was as public as any square in the city and filled with the noise of children. And all this confirmed the universal sovereignty of this man, who had his own ambassadors in every court in the world, consuls in every province, agencies in every city, and vessels on every sea. He was no speculator, no master adventurer handling other people's millions and dreaming, like Saccard, of heroic battles in which he would be victorious and win some colossal booty thanks to the help of gold, that mercenary enlisted in his service. He was, as he would often good-humouredly say, a simple money trader, but the cleverest and keenest there could be. But to establish his power, he had to dominate the bourse. So each settlement was a new battle in which victory was unfailingly his, thanks to the decisive power of his big battalions. Watching him, Saccard was for a moment overwhelmed by the thought that all the money that Gundermann was moving around was his own, and that he had, in his vaults, an inexhaustible merchandise, that he bought and sold like a wise and wily trader, an absolute master, obeyed at a glance, and determined to hear, see, and do everything for himself. A billion of one's own, handled in this way, is an impregnable force.
"We shan't have a minute to ourselves, my friend," Gundermann came back to say. "Look, I'm going to have lunch now. Come with me into the next room. Perhaps we'll get a bit of peace."
It was the small dining room of the mansion, the one used in the morning when the family was never present all at the same time. That day, there were only 19 at the table, of whom 8 were children. The banker sat in the middle, with just a bowl of milk before him. He sat for a moment with his eyes closed, drained with fatigue, his face very pale and drawn, for he had a malady of the liver and kidneys. Then, when he had, with trembling hands, carried the bowl to his lips and drunk a mouthful, he sighed.
"Oh, I'm worn out today."
"Why don't you rest?" asked Saccard. Gundermann turned to him with an astonished expression, and simply answered,
"But I can't."
And indeed, he wasn't even allowed to drink his milk in peace, for the reception of jobbers had resumed, and now came galloping through the dining room, while the men and women of the family, used to all this rushing about, laughed and tucked into the cold meats and pastries, while the children, excited by a mouthful of undiluted wine, were making a deafening row. And Saccard, still watching him, marveled to see him swallow his milk in slow gulps, with such an effort that it seemed he would never reach the bottom of the bowl. He had been put on a diet of milk. He couldn't touch meat or cake any more. So what good was a billion? Nor had he ever been tempted by women. For 40 years he had remained strictly faithful to his wife, and now his good behavior was compulsory, definitive, and irrevocable. So why get up at 5 in the morning, do this abominable job, be crushed by this immense fatigue, and lead the life of a galley slave, a life that no beggarman would accept, his memory stuffed with numbers, and his skull bursting with a multitude of worries? Why add more useless gold to so much gold, when you can't even buy a pound of cherries to eat in the street, or take some passing girl to a dance hall by the river, or enjoy any of the things that can be bought, like idleness and freedom? And Saccard, who, for all his terrible appetites, still recognized the disinterested love of money for the power it gives, felt seized by a kind of sacred terror at seeing this figure before him. Not the classic miser hoarding his gold, but the blameless worker with no physical needs, an almost abstract figure in his ailing old age, obstinately continuing to build his tower of millions, with the sole dream of leaving it to his descendants, so that they could make it even bigger, until it would dominate the earth. At last, Gundermann leaned over, and allowed him quietly to explain his planned creation of the Universal Bank. However, Saccard was sparing of details, and made just one allusion to the projects in Hammerland's portfolio, having sensed from his very first words that the banker wanted to get him to tell all, being resolved in advance to turn him away afterwards.
"Another bank, my dear friend! Another bank!"
Gundermann repeated in a mocking tone.
"But what I'd rather put my money into would be a machine. Yes, a guillotine, to chop the heads off all these banks that are being set up. Hmm? Or a rig to clean out the bourse. Hasn't your engineer got one of those among his papers?"
Then, affecting a paternal air, he said with tranquil cruelty,
"Come on, be sensible. You know what I told you. You're wrong to go back into business. I'm doing you a favor in refusing to launch your syndicate. You will inevitably go down. It's a mathematical certainty. You're too passionate, and you have too much imagination. Besides, things always go wrong when one is dealing with other people's money. Why doesn't your brother find you a nice position, hmm? As a prefect, or collector of revenues, or... No, not a collector of revenues. That's too dangerous. Beware, my friend. Beware."
Trembling, Saccard had risen to his feet.
"So, it's quite decided. You won't take any shares. You don't want to be with us."
"With you? Absolutely never. You'll be eaten up within 3 years.
There was a silence, pregnant with battle, and a sharp exchange of challenging looks.
"Goodbye, then. I haven't had lunch yet, and I'm hungry. We shall see which one of us gets eaten up."
And Saccard left him surrounded by his tribe, still noisily scoffing pastries, receiving the last tardy dealers, occasionally closing his eyes in weariness while he finished his bowl in little sips, his lips all white with milk. Saccard flung himself into his cab, giving the address of the Rue Saint-Lazare. 1 o'clock was striking. The day was wasted. And he went home to have lunch, beside himself with rage. Oh, that dirty Jew! Now there, for sure, was one he would really have liked to crush with a single bite, the way a dog crunches a bone. But as for devouring him, he was too terrible and large a morsel. But then, who could tell? Even the greatest empires had collapsed, and the time always comes when even the powerful succumb. No, he shouldn't try to devour him, but take a bite out of him, tear a few shreds off his billion, and then devour him, yes, why not? And so destroy them all in the person of their undisputed king, these Jews who thought themselves the masters of the feast. And these reflections, this anger that he carried away from his meeting with Gundermann, filled Saccard with a furious zeal, a need for business, a need for immediate success. He would have liked to build his banking house with a wave of his hand, and set it to work to triumph and crush the rival banks. Suddenly, the memory of Desgremont came back to him, and with no pause for further thought, in one irresistible movement, he leaned forward and shouted to the coachman to drive to the Rue Rochefoucauld. If he wanted to see Desgremont, he needed to make haste. He could always lunch later on, for he knew Desgremont went out at about 1 o'clock. Without any doubt, this Christian was worth 2 Jews. He was viewed as an ogre who devoured new enterprises entrusted to his care. But at that moment, Saccard would have dealt with Cartouche himself for the sake of victory, even if it meant sharing the winnings. Later on, they'd see he would be the victor. Meanwhile, the cab, climbing with difficulty the steep slope of the street, came to a halt before the high monumental gate of one of the last grand mansions of this district, which had seen some very fine ones. The main body of buildings, at the far end of a vast, paved courtyard, had an air of royal grandeur, and the garden beyond, still lined with century-old trees, remained a real park, quite remote from the crowded streets. All of Paris knew this mansion for its splendid entertainments, and above all, its admirable collection of paintings, which no Grand Duke on his travels would fail to visit. Married to a woman renowned for her beauty, like his paintings, and who was brilliantly successful in society as a singer, the master of the house led the life of a prince, as proud of his racing stable as his gallery. He belonged to one of the grand clubs, was seen with the most expensive women, had a box at the opera, a chair at the Hotel Drouot, and a reserved seat in all the fashionable, disreputable places. And all of this expansive life, this luxury, blazing in an apotheosis of caprice and art, was entirely paid for by speculation, a constantly shifting fortune which seemed as infinite as the sea, but also ebbed and flowed like the sea, with differences of 200,000 or 300,000 francs at every fortnightly settlement. When Saccard had climbed up the majestic front steps, a valet announced him, and led him through 3 reception rooms, laden with marvels, to a small smoking room where Desgremont was just finishing a cigar before going out. Already 45, battling against stoutness, he was tall, very elegant with an immaculate hairstyle, and sported just a moustache and a goatee beard, like a true devotee of the Tuileries. He showed great amiability and total self-confidence, certain of having the upper hand. He hurried forward at once.
"Ah, my dear friend, what have you been doing with yourself? I was just thinking of you the other day. But aren't we now neighbours?"
However, he calmed down, abandoning the effusiveness he kept for the rank and file, when Saccard, deciding there was no need for excessive subtlety, came straight to the point of his visit. He spoke of his great project, and explained that before founding the Universal Bank, with a capital of 25 million francs. He was looking to form a syndicate of friends, bankers, and industrialists, who would guarantee in advance the success of the share issue by committing themselves to taking up 4/5 of the issue, in other words, at least 40,000 shares. D'Aigremont had become very serious, listening and watching him as if probing the depths of his brain, to see what effort, what activity useful to himself he might yet get out of this man whom he had seen so active, so full of marvellous qualities in his disorganized enthusiasm. At first, he hesitated.
No, I'm overloaded already. I don't want to take on anything new.
Then, tempted all the same, he asked some questions, wanting to know what projects the new lending house would sponsor, projects which his interlocutor was wise enough to outline only with the utmost restraint. And when he learned of the first project which would be launched, the consolidation of all the transport companies of the Mediterranean under the corporate name of the United General Steamboat Company, he seemed very struck by the idea and gave in all at once.
Very well, I agree to join in, but on one condition. How do things stand with your brother, the minister?
Saccard, surprised, was frank enough to show his bitterness.
With my brother? Oh, he takes care of his business and I take care of mine. He's rather short of fraternal feeling, my brother.
Ah, well, too bad then, D'Aigremont declared firmly. I will only be with you if your brother is in it too. You understand? I don't want you to be on bad terms.
With an angry gesture of impatience, Saccard protested. What did they need Rougon for? Wasn't that just looking for chains to bind themselves hand and foot? But at the same time, a voice of good sense, stronger than his irritation, was telling him that he had at least to ensure the neutrality of the great man. Meanwhile, he went on refusing violently.
No, he's always been too much of a swine to me. I will never take the first step.
Listen, D'Aigremont went on. I'm expecting Huret at 5 o'clock about a little job he's doing for me. You go along to the Chamber of Deputies, take Huret aside and tell him your plans. He will talk to Rougon about it straight away and find out what he thinks. Then we'll have the answer at 5. So, meet here at 5?
With lowered head, Saccard was thinking it over.
Oh, Lord! If that's what you want!
Yes, absolutely. Without Rougon, nothing. With Rougon, whatever you like.
Very well, I'll go.
He was leaving, after a vigorous handshake, when the other called him back.
Ah, look here. If you feel that things are starting to come together, then, on your way back, drop in on the Marquis de Bohun and Cédille. Let them know that I'm in, and ask them to join us. I want them to be in on it.
At the door, Saccard found his cab, which he had kept, even though he only had to go to the end of the street to get home. He sent it away, reflecting that he could use his own carriage in the afternoon, and quickly went home to have lunch. They had given up waiting for him, so it was the cook herself who served him a slice of cold meat, which he devoured, all the while quarrelling with the coachman, for the latter, when summoned, had recounted the visit to the vet, the result of which was that the horse had to be allowed to rest for 3 or 4 days. With his mouth full, Saccard accused the coachman of not looking after the horse properly, and threatened him with Madame Caroline, who would soon sort him out. In the end, he shouted at him at least to go and find a cab. An utterly torrential downpour was once more sweeping across the street, and Saccard had to wait more than 1/4 hour for the carriage, finally getting in under a deluge of water and flinging out the address.
The Chamber of Deputies!
His plan was to arrive before the session began, so as to catch Huret on the way in and have a quiet word with him. Unfortunately, a heated debate was expected to take place that day, for a member of the opposition was going to bring up the constantly recurring question of Mexico, and Rougon, no doubt, would be forced to reply. As Saccard entered the long entrance hall, he was lucky enough to chance upon the deputy. Huret,
took him into one of the little reception rooms nearby. There they were alone, thanks to the great excitement going on in the corridors. The opposition was becoming more and more of a threat. The wind of disaster was starting to blow, a wind that would grow stronger and blow everything down. So the preoccupied Hure didn't immediately understand, and made Saccard explain twice over the mission he was being given. This only increased his alarm.
"Oh, my dear friend, what are you thinking of? Try to talk to Rougon just now. He'll send me packing for sure."
Then, concern for his own personal interests came to the fore. He only existed through the great man, to whom he owed his official candidature, his election, and his position as a general dog's body, living on the crumbs of his master's favor. In this job for the past 2 years, thanks to bribes, and some prudent under-the-counter earnings, he had been enlarging his vast estates in Calvados, with the intention of retiring there and living like a lord after the downfall. His broad face, that of a wily peasant, had darkened, showing his confusion at this request for him to intervene, without giving him time to work out whether this would be to his personal benefit or detriment.
"No, no, I cannot. I passed on your brother's wishes to you. I can't go back to him again. Good heavens, have some consideration for me. He's hardly what you'd call gentle with people who bother him. And Lord, I have no desire to take the rap for you and lose my standing with him."
Then Saccard, getting the drift, now concentrated solely on convincing Hure of the millions to be gained in the launching of the Universal Bank. In broad strokes, with his ardent words transforming a business venture into a poetic tale, he outlined the magnificent operations and the certain and colossal success. D'Egremont, full of enthusiasm, was putting himself at the head of the syndicate. Mohan and Cédille had already asked to be part of it. It was impossible that he, Hure, should not take part. These gentlemen were insisting he should be with them, on account of his high political position. They were even hoping that he would consent to be on the board of directors, since his name stood for order and probity. At the promise of appointment to the board, Hure looked him straight in the eye.
"All right, then. What is it you want of me? What response do you want me to get from Rougon?"
"My word," said Saccard. "For myself, I would happily have done without my brother. But it's D'Egremont who insists that I make my peace with him. Maybe he's right. So I think you should simply tell the terrible fellow about our business, and obtain, if not his help, then at least a promise that he won't be against us."
Hure, with half-closed eyes, still could not decide.
"Look, if you bring back a kind word, just a kind word, do you understand? Then D'Egremont will be satisfied, and the three of us will get it all sewn up this evening."
"Well then, I'll try,"
the deputy declared roughly, affecting a peasant's bluntness.
"But just as well it's for you, because he's not an easy man. Oh no, especially when he's being teased by the left. 5 o'clock then."
5 o'clock.
Saccard stayed on for nearly an hour, very worried by the rumors going round about a struggle. He heard one of the great opposition orators announce that he was going to speak. On hearing this, he wanted for a moment to get back to Hure to ask him if it wouldn't be wiser to put off the meeting with Rougon until the next day. Then, fatalistic and believing in chance, he trembled at the idea of everything being compromised if he altered what had been decided. Perhaps, in all the commotion, his brother would more easily let slip the word they hoped for. And to allow things to sort themselves out, he left, got back in his cab, and was already on the way back to the Pont de la Concorde, when he remembered the wish that D'Egremont had expressed.
"Driver, Rue de Babylone."
The Rue de Babylone was where Marquis de Bohain lived. He occupied the former outbuildings of a grand mansion, a building which had once housed the stable staff, and which had been made into a very comfortable modern house. The furnishings were luxurious, with a fine air of chic aristocracy. His wife was never seen, being unwell, said the Marquis, and kept to her apartment by infirmity. However,
The house and furniture were hers, and he merely lodged there in a furnished apartment, owning only his personal effects in a trunk he could have carried away in a cab. They had been legally separated ever since he started living on speculation. There had been two catastrophes already, in which he had blankly refused to pay what he owed, and the official receiver, having taken stock of the situation, had not even bothered to send him an official document. The slate was simply wiped clean. As long as he won, he pocketed the money. Then, when he lost, he didn't pay. Everyone knew it, and everyone was resigned to it. He had an illustrious name. He made an excellent ornament for boards of directors, so new companies looking for golden mastheads fought over him. He was never unemployed. At the Bourse, he had his own chair on the Rue Notre-Dame des Victoires side, the side of the rich speculators who pretended to take no interest in the petty rumours of the day. He was respected and much consulted. He had often had an influence on the market. In short, he was a real personage. Saccard knew him well, but was nevertheless impressed by the extreme courtesy of the reception he received from this handsome old man of 60, his very small head set on the body of a colossus, and his pale face, framed by a dark wig, looking extremely grand.
"Monsieur le Marquis, I've come to seek your help."
He explained the reason for his visit, without at first going into details. Besides, from his very first words, the Marquis stopped him.
"No, no, my time is all taken up. I already have 10 proposals that I shall have to refuse."
Then, when Saccard smiled and added, "It was Négremont who sent me. It was he who thought of you," he at once cried,
"Ah, you have Négremont in with you. Fine, fine. If Négremont is involved, then so am I. You can count on me."
And when the visitor tried to provide him with at least a bit of information, to let him know what sort of business he was getting into, he silenced him with the amiable nonchalance of a great lord who doesn't go into such details and has a natural confidence in the honesty of people.
"Please, don't say another word. I do not wish to know. You need my name? I lend it to you. And I am very happy to do so. That's all. Just tell Négremont to arrange things as he thinks best."
As he got back in his cab, Saccard, greatly cheered, laughed to himself.
"He'll be expensive, that fellow," he thought, "but he really is very charming."
Then aloud, he said,
"Driver, Rue de Jeuneur."
That was where Cédille had his warehouses and offices, which occupied the whole of the vast ground floor at the far end of a courtyard. After 30 years of work, Cédille, who came from Lyon, where he still had some workshops, had at last succeeded in making his silk business one of the best known and most solid in Paris when, after some chance incident, a passion for speculation had manifested itself and spread right through him with the violent destructiveness of a fire. 2 considerable wins, one after another, made him lose his head. What was the point of giving 30 years of one's life to earning a paltry million, when one could pocket that much in 1 hour with a simple transaction on the Bourse? From that moment on, he had gradually lost all interest in his business, which carried on under its own momentum, but he now lived entirely in the hope of some financial coup on the market. And since bad luck had come his way, and persisted, he had begun to swallow up in his gambling all the profits from his business. The worst of this fever is that one loses the taste for legitimate earnings, and ends up having no clear idea at all about money, and ruin inevitably lay ahead if the workshops in Lyon earned him 200,000 francs, while he lost 300,000 on the stock market. Saccard found Cédille looking agitated and worried, for, as a speculator, he was neither stoical nor philosophical. He lived in a state of constant guilt, always hopeful, always disappointed, and sick with uncertainty, for he remained an honest man at heart. The settlement at the end of April had just proved disastrous for him. However, His plump face with thick blonde sideburns took on some colour at Saccard's first words.
Well, my dear chap, if it's luck you're bringing me, then you're very welcome.
Then, however, he took fright.
No, no, don't tempt me. I'd do better to lock myself in with my lengths of silk and not budge from my encounter.
To help him calm down, Saccard talked to him about his son Gustave, mentioning that he'd seen him that morning at Mazzod's. But this was yet another source of grief for the merchant, for he had dreamed of handing over his business to his son, who, however, despised trade. He was a creature made for joy and festivities, with the white teeth that the sons of parvenus have, teeth only good for crunching up ready-made fortunes. His father had placed him with Mazzod to see if he might get his teeth into financial matters.
Ever since his poor mother died, he murmured, he's given me little enough cause for satisfaction. Anyway, perhaps there in that office he may learn things that will be useful to me.
Well then, said Saccard briskly, are you with us? Degremont told me to come and tell you that he was in it.
Sadil raised his trembling arms to the sky, and in a voice marked by both desire and fear,
but yes, of course I am. You know very well I can't do otherwise than join in. If I refused, and your venture flourished, I'd be sick with regret. Tell Degremont I'm in.
Once back in the street, Saccard took out his watch and saw it was barely 4 o'clock. With plenty of time ahead of him, an impulse to walk for a while prompted him to let his cab go. He regretted this almost immediately, for he had not even reached the boulevard when a new shower, a deluge of rain and hail, forced him to seek refuge in a doorway. What filthy weather for conquering Paris! After watching the rain falling for a quarter of an hour, impatience overcame him, and he hailed an empty cab that was passing. It was a Victoria, and try as he might to pull the leather apron over his legs, he arrived at the Rue La Rochefoucauld, soaked through, and a full half hour early. In the smoking room where the valet left him, saying that Monsieur had not yet returned, Saccard walked around slowly, looking at the pictures. But a superb female voice, a contralto of deep and melancholy power, rose up from within the silence of the house, and he went over to the open window to listen. It was Madame at the piano, rehearsing a piece she would no doubt be singing that evening at some reception. Then, lulled by the music, he began to recall the extraordinary stories told about Degremont, especially the tale of the Hadamantine Company, that loan of 50 million francs in which he had kept back the entire stock, getting it sold and resold 5 times over using his own dealers, until he had created a market for it and established a price. Then, when serious selling began, came the inevitable fall from 300 to 15 francs, and enormous profits were made out of a little group of simple souls who were all instantly ruined. Ah, he was good at it. Quite terrible. The voice of Madame continued, sending forth a lament of despairing love, of tragic depth. Meanwhile, Saccard, getting back into the middle of the room, paused in front of a Meissonier, which he guessed to be worth 100,000 francs. But someone came in, and he was surprised to see that it was Huret.
What? You're here already? It's not yet 5. Is the session finished, then?
Ah, yes, finished. They're still squabbling.
And he explained that as the opposition member was still talking, Rougon would certainly be unable to deliver his response until tomorrow. So when he realized this, he had risked pestering the minister again, very hurriedly, during a brief pause in the session.
And? Saccard asked irritably. What did my illustrious brother say?
Hooray didn't answer straight away.
Oh, he was in an absolutely foul mood. I must admit, I was counting on the state of exasperation he was in, hoping he'd simply send me packing. So I told him about your affair, and said you didn't want to undertake anything without his approval.
So?
So then he seized me by both arms, shook me, and yelled into my face, let him go and get himself hanged! And then he left me standing there.
Saccard, suddenly very pale,
gave a forced laugh.
That's good of him.
I'll say, yes, it is good,
Hooray carried on, in a tone of conviction. I wasn't expecting as much. With that, we can get on with things.
And as he heard in the next room the footsteps of Desgrammont returning home, he added quietly,
Leave it to me.
Of course, Hooray was very keen to see the Universal Bank founded and to be in on it. He had no doubt already worked out what part he might play. So, as soon as he had shaken hands with Desgrammont, he took on a radiant expression and waved his arms in the air.
Victory! He cried. Victory!
Ah, really? Tell me all about it.
My word, the great man was all that he was meant to be. He replied, May my brother succeed.
At this, Desgrammont was utterly delighted and thought the remark quite charming.
May he succeed.
That said it all. If he's stupid enough to fail, I'll abandon him. But so long as he succeeds, I'll help him. Truly exquisite.
And my dear Saccard, we shall succeed, have no fear. We shall do everything required to that end.
Then, when the three men were sitting down to decide on the main points, Desgrammont got up and closed the window. For Madame's voice, gradually getting louder, was tearing out such a sob of infinite despair that they could not hear each other speak. And even with the window shut, that banished lamentation still accompanied them while they settled on the creation of a lending house, the Universal Bank, with a capital of 25 million francs, divided into 50,000 shares of 500 francs each. It was further agreed that Desgrammont, Hooray, Cédille, the Marquis de Bohun, and a few of their friends would form a syndicate which would in advance take up and share between them 4/5 of the stock. In other words, 40,000 shares. In this way, the success of the share issue was guaranteed, and later on, holding on to the securities and making them scarce in the market, they could make their value rise at will. But everything almost came adrift when Desgrammont demanded a bonus of 400,000 francs, spread across the 40,000 shares, that is, 10 francs per share. Saccard protested, declaring that it was unreasonable to make the cow moo even before they milked her. Things would be difficult enough at the beginning, so why complicate the situation further? He had to give in, however, faced with the attitude of Hooray, who calmly said he found it quite natural, and that was how it was always done. They were going their separate ways, having agreed a meeting for the next day, a meeting at which the engineer Hamelin was to be present, when Desgrammont suddenly struck his brow with an expression of despair.
I was forgetting Kolb! Oh, he'd never forgive me. He must be in on this. Saccard, dear boy, would you be so kind as to go to him straight away? It's not yet 6 o'clock. You'd still find him at home. Yes, you, yourself. And now, this evening, not tomorrow, because that will make a good impression on him and he can be useful to us.
Saccard obediently set off once more, conscious that lucky days don't come around twice. But he had yet again dismissed his cab, hoping to return home only a few yards away. And as the rain seemed at last to be stopping, he went on foot, happy to feel beneath his heels these Paris streets he was reconquering. In the Rue Montmartre, a few drops of rain made him decide to go by way of the covered passages. He went through the Passage Verdot and the Passage Jouffroy. Then, in the Passage des Panoramas, as he was taking a short cut to the Rue Vivienne through a side arcade, he was surprised to see Gustave Cédille coming out of a dark alley and disappearing without turning round. Saccard, too, had stopped, and was looking at the house, a discreet establishment of furnished rooms, when a small blonde woman, wearing a veil, also came out, and he clearly recognized Madame Conin, the pretty stationer's wife. So this was where she brought her one-day lovers, when she had a fancy for love, while that great, jolly fellow of a husband of hers thought she was out chasing up bills. This secluded spot, right in the middle of the district, was very nicely chosen. and it was the merest chance that had revealed its secret. Saccard smiled, quite cheered up, envying Gustave. Germain Coeur in the morning, Madame Cornin in the afternoon. That young man was getting double helpings. And he looked twice more at the door so he could remember it, much tempted to be in on the act himself. In the Rue Vivienne, just as he was going into Kolb's house, Saccard gave a start and again came to a halt. A light, crystalline music, coming up from the ground like the voice of the fairies of legend, wrapped itself around him, and he recognized the music of gold, the constant tinkling of this district of trade and speculation, the sound he had already heard that morning. The end of the day seemed to be linking up with the beginning. He basked in the caressing sound of that voice, as if it were confirming his good omens. Kolb was in fact downstairs in the smelting workshop, and as a friend of the family, Saccard went down to join him. In the bareness of the basement, eternally lit by large gas flames, the two smelters were using spades to empty the zinc-lined chests, today full of Spanish coins, which they were throwing into the crucible on the big square furnace. The heat was fierce. One had to talk loudly to be heard amid the harmonica-like ringing, which resounded under the low vaulted ceiling. Newly forged ingots, slabs of gold with the vivid brilliance of new metal, were lined up along the table of the assayer, who fixed their values. And since that morning, more than 6 million had gone through, giving the banker a profit of scarcely 300 or 400 francs. For the arbitrage on gold, on the difference realized between two currency markets, is of the slightest, counted in thousandths. So very substantial quantities of molten metal are needed to yield any profit. Hence, this tinkling of gold, this stream of gold from morning to night, from one year's end to the next, down in this cellar, where gold arrived in minted coins and left in gold ingots, only to return as coins and leave again as ingots, indefinitely, with the sole object of leaving in the hands of the dealer a few particles of gold. Kolb was a small, very dark man, whose nose, like an eagle's beak, emerging from a dense beard, gave away his Jewish origins, and as soon as he had understood what Saccard was offering, even through the rattling hail of gold, he accepted.
"Perfect!" he cried. "Glad to be in on it, if Degremont is in on it. And thank you for going to so much trouble."
But they could scarcely hear each other, and both felt silent, standing there for a moment longer, blissfully dazed by that clear and furious ringing which made their flesh quiver, like too high a note on a violin, held for so long that it makes one shudder. Outside, in spite of the return of good weather and a limpid May evening, Saccard, desperately tired, called another cab to take him home. A hard day, but well spent.